Hi, I'm Skating PJ, and this is Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast, where we're going to get up close and personal with members of our skating family who have a connection to Ontario. So, let's talk about it. Hi, everybody. At Skating PJ here with another great episode of Let's Talk About It for Skate Ontario. Today, I am thrilled to be talking with somebody to whom I've had a connection basically my whole life. We are members of the skating family. She is a proud member of the Figure Skating Hall of Fame of Skate Canada. She is an honorary life member of the International Skating Union and basically my friend. Please say hi to Anne Shaw. Anne, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. PJ, how are you?
I am well, thank you. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is sort of, this is our Olympic season, and we're talking a little bit about, Olympic Games and kind of what that's like, and I know you've officiated. Now, I will tell you, in my research, some places say 2 Olympic Games, some places say 3. Which is it?
3.
That's what I thought.
2 as judge and 1 as assistant referee.
Amazing. Okay, let's start from the very beginning. And the very beginning is about you as a kid, your connection to figure skating. Where did it start? And we're going to mention University Skating Club, which, by the way, is where I first started coaching. But that's a story for a different day. Anyway, let's get started. Where and why figure skating?
When I was 6, I was enrolled in ballet. My parents didn't have a lot of money, so we could do one thing a year. And I didn't really like ballet. I found it very static. I guess it was all those first positions and second positions and no movement through the surface. So we heard the next year that a little skating club called Silver Blades was opening in Ravenna Gardens, which was in the West End. And we lived in the West End. And so I joined Silver Blades. And from then on, I was hooked to skating. Just loved the movement. Loved falling and getting up and figuring out that I'd fallen as many times the next day as I had the day before. But that was the beginning. And then I eventually, as you said, did go to University Skating Club, which I guess ended up proving to be the impetus for my interest in ice dance, because it was such an ice dancing club, as you know.
Do you know what? You and I are both ice dance fans. That's for sure, from way back. What I want to know, though, is now that we've got a great story on our website at skateontario.org / In the Loop, which is Welcome Home, Anne Shaw, which was written by Debbie Wilkes. She has a great series of sort of one-on-one conversations with people. But I want to know that glide. What hooked you about gliding? Now, I imagine if you're at the public sort of session at Silver Blades, that it was kind of chopped up ice, but nevertheless, the glide, what does it mean to you?
Well, it means movement. It means freedom. It means, to get the glide, of course, you need to be using your knees and just, I'm a great believer in use of knees. So just effortless gaining of speed and the feeling of the air whizzing by, I guess, and the depth that is in associated with glide, because I love the edge aspect of the skating as well. The edginess of the whole thing.
When you started sort of studying or really learning about ice dance, what was your favorite compulsory dance? And then I'll tell you mine.
Eventually the Argentine tango.
Me too! What are the odds?
It's a gorgeous dance.
I think so too. What did you like about it?
I think the timing. I love tangos for one thing. I think tangos are so much fun. I loved the difficulty of it. I loved the timing, the and one timing within the Argentine tango.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, and 1, 2, 3, 4. The repetitiveness. I love rhythm. So I think that was it. It was hard to do.
It was hard to do. And those back cross rolls.
Yes. Back cross rolls I loved. Can't say I love the twizzle as much. I eventually came to love the twizzle.
Me neither.
Eating it with a partner, it was wonderful.
Now, you had two different partners, and you finished as high as fifth in the world with one partner and sixth in the world with the other. Mm-hmm. So as an elite athlete in those days, because, of course, ice dance in your day and also in mine was not at the Olympic Games. So what were the world championships like in ice dance in your day?
I was in 59 with Eddie Collins. He was competing in singles also at that world championship. Which is a feat in itself. So we were in Colorado Springs, and the arena was very small there in contrast to the arenas they use for Olympics today. I always heard that if they took the ice out of that rink, the pipes would have all rotted, and they kept their pipes in all. It was a very small but beautiful location. And so we didn't have as many entrants because it was in North America that year. Can't remember, maybe 15 or 12 even, but it was still an exciting event. They used to have a parade through the town of Colorado Springs. We were all given cowboy outfits to go in this parade in these convertibles with the chance to wave to the crowds, and there were crowds gathered to watch us. It was quite exciting. The next year was in Vancouver in 1960 when I was skating with Gilles Vinesse. And that year, it was a post-Olympic year because they had just come from, the skaters were coming from Squaw Valley. Again, not a huge field in those days. So my fifth and sixth sound better than they actually were, probably.
I don't think so. First of all, when you think of the number of skaters who would have loved to have gone to a world championships and then to get there and to still be in, you know, within shooting distance of a medal in those days, I think it's quite an accomplishment.
I was in grade 13 for my first Worlds, and I was in first year university for my second Worlds. So I was also doing my academic stuff along with it. So it was a busy time for me.
Do you know, I've often heard it said that if you want something done, give it to a busy person because they have a way of slotting things in. And also that whole time management thing, which would have been very much front of mind, I'm sure, in those days. What was the competition in your day? Was it three compulsory dances and a free dance, or what was the structure?
Sometimes it was four compulsory dances, but usually three and a free dance. And we early on, we actually had an elimination round, and then we all went on the ice for the final round skating. There'd be four couples in a final round.
At the same time?
Ballroom. Yeah, it was really weird. Yeah, like ballroom. But that was really early on. That wasn't the case at World Championships. But it was three compulsory dances. But we also, the draw for those was huge because we would practice at least 10 per year. It's not like the dancers today, more recently until they dropped compulsory dance. But, you know, at that time, they'd say you're doing two dances for the year and you'd work on those all year. Well, we had to work on a slate of at least 10 dances. Sometimes, I think in the earlier years, it was even 18. And then we'd have the draw just before the event. So we'd find out which of the dances we were doing. So all of our dances were up in terms of caliber. We had to keep them all up.
Did you have the same kind of openings that they had, or did you just start with a couple of introductory steps and then into the set pattern?
We just started with plain... We had no free dance into the compulsory.
I was going to say free dance into the compulsory, but I just decided, no, stay away from that. Be good.
No, we were quite simple. But, now, but I think we were good, though. I think we certainly had good edge and we had good technique, generally speaking. And a good timing.
Yeah.
Timing was so important.
And it still is, as far as I'm concerned. Because, you know, honestly, that's where you can separate the wheat from the chaff, as my mom used to say, is in the sort of in the basics. So at the time, and I 100% disagree, but it was felt that ice dancing wasn't somehow as athletic or as demanding as single skating and as pair skating. Can you talk to me a little bit about that first Olympic Games with ice dance and kind of what that meant to you? And did you see it coming? And how exciting was it?
Well, I think it was very exciting to finally get it on the Olympic list. Pakhomov and Gorshkov were competing for Russia, won that Olympics. And she was terrific. He became a little better through the years. He ended up as the chair of the dance technical committee. I knew him well. I worked with him on that committee. But it was exciting to get it on the spectrum, frankly. Yes. I was very, very happy.
Do you, how do you feel about the statement when people say that ice dance was not as demanding somehow?
I think it probably wasn't.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean, we practiced, but we I really think that we didn't have the jumps. We didn't have the danger factor. The complexity now in ice dance, we've made it hard. We made people fall, or they gave them the possibility of falling, because the lifts and things they're doing now are extra difficult. But in those days, we didn't have that complexity. We didn't have the danger of falling. If you fell in a compulsory dance, that would have been just disaster, frankly. But it didn't happen much. We weren't falling much.
I love the fact that you say we didn't have the danger factor, because I certainly believe now that a lot of those lifts are, in fact, death-defying, because mm-hmm. they're done, you know, the partners are perhaps way far apart. So it's not like a pairlift where they're one unit in terms of balance. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the evolution of the different tricks, the different kind of elements? How surprised are you when you see something new? Like, for instance, Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer and their Grey Goose lift at the Olympic Games in 2010.
Well, I was involved in, you know, creating that system that brought in all of these lifts. So I was quite pleased to see these developments. I do worry a little bit now that they've extended the length of the lifts. I know they did it so that they could reflect a bigger, more complicated entry and exit and so on. But I don't want lifts to take over programs, frankly, or elements to take over programs. I think we still have to have, in ice dance, we still have to have basic dancey footwork and position changes and so on. So I think that's important. But I'm thrilled to see some of the things they're doing. I used to love Tessa and Scott's lift. I thought that was fantastic. They ended up not being able to do it eventually. They banned it, but it was fantastic. It was because it was a jump out, and they weren't allowed to jump out of a lift.
When I'm thinking about sort of so many of the things in ice dance now, and in addition to everything else, I'm a fan. What I want to still see, though, is, and it's kind of old school thinking, probably it's probably a symptom of my age, but I love the expression of a rhythm. And I think sometimes now, when we're seeing just in my mind, lots of what I call meaningful slow part pieces of music, there isn't that kind of genre that you can go, oh my goodness, that's a quick step, that's a tango, that's a waltz, that's a whatever. So I would love to see, and I think the dancers are best. I mean, they're the wizards of the blade, that's for sure, in terms of the edges. But I love that kind of expression that was just, you know, it jumped up and smacked you in the face back in the day. But what do you think about the expression of music?
Well, I do feel strongly, like you do, that it needs to be there. I feel that the last few years, the selection of choices they've made in the rhythm dance, what they call the original, their rhythm dance, is not as interesting as it was when it was an OSP, original set, modern dance, or something like that, because one rhythm was set. And I loved it because it was wonderful to judge, because you were actually judging the ability of the dancers to show you that they really understood that rhythm and could do it beautifully. And some couldn't, some skated beautifully, some even seemed to dance, but you can't dance unless you're really dancing to the rhythm on time. So I feel the selection for the last few years, with the exception perhaps of this year, has not been as wise as it might have been. 2 years ago, it was music from the, I think it's 50s, 60s, 70s, three decades of music. So you weren't comparing apples and oranges, fruits. You were comparing apples and tomatoes and maybe a car thrown in. You know, you weren't comparing the same thing. And I think because of that, the stress on the expression of a rhythm got lost a bit. Last year, it was a little better, even though it was a broad period. They had, I think, 60s, 70s music, 50s, 60s, 70s, but at least it was rock or it was disco or it was peppy music. And so there was a little more comparison in terms of how they could express the faster tempo music and the more modern music. They're going next year again to a broad spectrum 90s music, but it doesn't say any rhythm.
Well, that's the problem with saying a decade, because if you go back to the 70s, let's say, you got disco, but you've also got sort of easy listening and folk music. You've got lots of different ways to sort of do things. Where if you say tango or you say quick step, you're not, you can use any kind of music as long as it goes within that rhythm. But then you're looking at something that's very specific. So
I would say some teams are still reflecting rhythm.
I think so, too.
Even in the free skate programs. I do think one of the problems with choreography, with the advent of, we did add vocal, and I see that sometimes people skate to the vocal, and they skate to the underlying rhythm, because it's you know, probably telling an emotional story or something, and they go on with that. But we've missed the phrasing of the pieces is part of the problem in some of these free dances today. They're not skating to the phrasing of the music, you know, groups of four in 4/4 time or groups of 6/8 time in waltz time. And so you don't get a sense of that rhythmic repetitive feeling. And it's a bit of a danger. You have to be very careful if you're a coach constructing a program to make sure that you do adhere to the phrasing. I think that would help some of the dancers if they were choosing music. It's the lyrical melody that goes over music, that if they skate only to that and never to the underbeat, it won't look like dance. It won't look like ice dance.
And me as a word person, if you're skating to I don't know, I'm trying to think of a piece of music that's very, you know, that has a very strong story or very strong whatever, I'll give you an example. Rhapsody in Blue, Ilya Kulik. And then that kind of cow outfit. I was so distracted by the outfit with Rhapsody in Blue, I can't even begin to tell you. So I'm a very literal kind of person. So if you're going to choose, that wasn't obviously vocal, but if you're going to choose a piece of music that has an underlying theme, I want it to all be sort of costume, choreography, concept. I want them to all be together. Mm-hmm. And I think ice dancers have the most unique opportunity to do that. And in many ways, I think that ice dance is the most accessible of the figure skating disciplines. That's the one that the casual fan at the Olympic Games lives for, to be able to watch, because they understand it, I think.
I agree with you. And I also want to say that the dancers today are they are the best skaters of all.
I agree.
I hate to hurt the feelings of the single skaters out there, but really what the dancers have to do in terms of edge, I can remember being rinkside when the hockey players from Canada were watching our Olympic dancers, and they were just in awe of the speed of the edge, especially the edge, the laying into the edges that we do. And now the complexity, I mean, the difficulty of everything we do, they really, really are so much better than we used to be. That's why I'm not sure all my friends, some of whom aren't alive now, would agree, but I think it is, they're the strongest skaters.
I think you're right. If you just talk skating, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about the Olympic Games, because this is our Olympic season. Mm-hmm. You were, so the first Olympic Games was for you, Sarajevo. In 1984?
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel nervous? Like, I've talked to athletes before about their feelings at going to the Olympic Games. What was that experience like for you?
Terrifying.
Okay.
I think you're always, it's the epitome of, you've always dreamed of improving your judging status. And that was the epitome at the time for me. At that Games, I judged from probably, well, I can tell you, at Worlds the year before in Helsinki, the compulsory dances took from 9 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. The compulsory dances would have been not taken quite as long at Olympics, but quite a long, substantial slice of the day. And you had to keep your wits about you for a long period of time. You just can't lose concentration for one second. So it's really quite an onerous task to
yes.
those things. And you also, and all judges are like this, we want to get things right. And in those days, of course, we had only two marks to use to get things right. And we had to make sure that our marks let us put people in the right order.
Yes.
Just sometimes we had to use a false mark to get the right order because we didn't want somebody whom we felt should have been fourth to end up fifth because yep. our mark math was incorrect. So it was quite a challenge. So, yeah, it was terrifying. And you're on worldwide TV.
Yep.
And the audience is large.
Yep.
So you don't yes. want to make a mistake, especially for your country. You're judging on behalf of your country and on behalf of the ISU. I mean, you've got a dual role in a sense.
You know, it's very interesting because many people won't know that there was a judging system before the current system. And the way that I've explained it is the old system was you had to kind of keep track of who in your mind was either best or worst and sort of work the rest of the field based on that sort of a benchmark. Mm-hmm. Today, you look at what somebody has done and you give a mark according, and then it doesn't really matter before or after what the next person does. It's just a question of adding each skater. Would that be an accurate way of describing it?
Partly, but I think the other thing about the system today is we, in the course of a free dance, we probably give 15 marks. Maybe 9 elements or whatever the number of elements are in a given year or for the rhythm dance. So you're giving, as each element is completed, you immediately assess it based on how good that is and you get rid of it. The same with singles. Like in the old days, you had to remember that did they do a quad, probably not a quad, a triple or a double Lutz or double Salchow or something, and keep that in mind when you're coming up with that mark at the end of their program. But in today, you just immediately assess the element, it's gone. And quite often at the end, you have no idea really how you've ranked. In the case of the judge, you're giving the mark for, you know, the level, not the yep. level, you're giving the mark for the GOE, the grade of execution. So it's plus, minus, whatever you're giving, but it's gone.
Yes.
So at the end of the program, when you come to do your components, and there were 5, there are now 3, you then do the assessing that we used to do in terms of the whole program. But you didn't have to remember all those elements they did in the meantime and get that all in your head too and come up with 2 marks because you only have 3 more marks to come up with. And you have sometimes when you finish, you have no idea where you've ended up placing them because you're not placing your marks.
Yes.
And whereas in the old days we were placing.
Exactly. Exactly. My mom used to say to people who would say back in the day that, you know, ice dance results didn't change from one segment to the next. And my mom used to say, and I think she was right, and she was an ice dance judge at the national level. She would say people's talent doesn't improve between compulsory dances. So somebody being in fourth in one compulsory dance is likely going to be fourth-ish in another compulsory dance because that's where their skill level is. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does to a degree.
Okay.
But then if they do something wrong,
yeah.
In the old days, we really needed to reflect that. If
yes, of course.
The timing or something. And sometimes I feel judges still tended to continue, a few judges from some countries, I'd say, tended to give the same mark whether they skated badly or well.
Yes, yes.
So there is fluctuation, but I think your mother was quite right in terms of general range. Yes.
Well, just helping people who are not skating people sort of understand kind of what's going on.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things. The other thing that people often ask is, why are you watching the practices? What's the purpose?
I think we watch too many practices.
Okay.
Frankly. But the purpose is to get a sense of range. We still need range for our component marks too.
Yes.
You still need to have a sense of, you know, this couple could be in the top 8 and this couple might be not in the top 8. It just gives you a general sense of where you're going. I think that's the only need for a practice, to see it maybe once. And
I'm sorry. No, you go ahead.
Frankly, you can watch practices too much and become absolutely numb with overwatching. Whereas if you're a technical specialist, you're a technical controller, of course, you have to go to the practices because you've got to, you don't have much time in assessing elements when they're happening. Yes. So it's a totally different thing. Technical controllers and technical specialists have to go to as many practices as they can go to help them.
And again, for the purposes of our audience who may not know a lot about it, that technical panel is responsible for what versus the judges?
The assigning of the level to the elements only. Then when the judges take that element, they are assessing how well the element was done, how difficult was the entry, how smooth, if it was a spin, how quick were the rotations, how beautiful was the movement through the rotations, all kinds of things. So how did they exit? Was it a beautiful exit, seamless entrance, or was it a telegraphed entrance or exit to an element? So you mark the quality of the element. And the panel, the technical panel, marks the quantity of the element in a sense. That's probably too simplified, but it's...
No, it's great.
Thinking of it.
It's great. I have a couple more questions because this has been the fastest half hour I have ever recorded. But my first question is, can you give me one of your favorite Olympic memories? Can be on the ice, off the ice, can be you, can be somebody else.
Well, I guess there were, I think I can give you two that really affected me. One was judging in Calgary in 88 Olympics because Wilson McCall won the first North American medal at that Olympics, and I was on the panel, so that was quite a thrill.
I bet.
I think the most exciting thing that I really felt was sitting in the stands in 2010 when Tessin Scott won the first North American Olympic medal. And I had been working with them that year. In fact, Skate Canada brought me to Olympics because I was sitting in the stands sort of saying, oh, that lift's too long, got to work on that, and talking to the team leader through the phone, just sort of saying, and we'd be discussing what they would be wearing that night and everything. So I was quite involved with them. That year, I was not officiating. I had retired from international judging in 2006 because I aged out. But anyway, so I really can, I'll never forget the audience that night when they won. It was a roar, the likes of which I've never heard. And I think we were all thrilled to have that happen. So that was very special as well.
Did you stay to watch the podium? Did you stay to watch the
medals? I was listening to when they came on to the podium to get the medals. It was just a scream, a unified scream that year, that night.
I'm pretty sure that, like many of us, you saw Tessa and Scott close to the very beginning of their career. So being, you know, two-time Olympic gold medalists is one thing. But, you know, they were also pre-novice champions, let's say. I don't know for sure if they were, but I think they were. Like, you watched them grow up. What were your impressions of them when you sort of first connected with them when they were kids to when they became these unbelievable legends?
Well, I have a story to tell you because I think I had used them to do an ISU film when they were 10. We were doing a technical film for the ISU on ice dances. And so I had them do 14-step and European waltz and a few of the technical things like a different type of turn or something for the demo. And I came home that day and I said to Bob, they're going to be world champions. And he's always reminded me, he said, do you remember when you came home from that session with them in Kitchener and said they're going to be world champions? And I think we all knew it from the beginning, didn't you, PJ?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember talking to Scott's older brother, Danny, who was part of my Ice Nightmare comedy men's synchronized skating team. And I said, you know, Danny, you were just such a wonderful ice dancer. And he said to me, I know, but I had to get out before my baby brother was going to beat me.
And speaking of that synchronized program you did with your male team, I was thinking of it last night as I was thinking of you. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life, PJ.
Ice Nightmare, we had so much fun. Oh my goodness. And we raised money for breast cancer research, which was a whole lot of fun too. So it was something that was close, near and dear to our hearts. Last question is about the skating family. you have grown up in figure skating. You are, a member, obviously, of the global skating family. What has that family membership meant to you?
In some ways, I've got more friends in the skating community than I do in my life in Toronto, because most of my life I've been away. When I was sitting on the ISU for 14 years on that technical committee, I was traveling 7 to 9 times a year to Europe or Asia. So I was with my friends on the dance technical committee and so on, seeing friends. And so, and at Canadian championships, we see people constantly. I've, you know, officiated almost every Canadian championship for years. So that group of friends with whom you've judged and cried, and, you know, coaches as well, because we worked with the coaches to help their skaters through the years. I monitored most of the Canadian senior dancers. We became very close. And I think it's because you were always doing things that were very difficult together. Like, it wasn't easy. We judges would support each other. If someone was judging men's and I was judging dance, we'd be supporting each other. We'd be supporting our coaches and so on as best we could, because we had to be neutral and once we got to an event. But anyway, it's that skating family that has remained important to me. My some of my very best friends are skaters.
Amazing. And one last thought before we go. What has skating meant to you? How can we encourage people to get on the ice?
Well, I was still skating when I was in my early 70s. I think it's a wonderful sport for everybody. I think it is something that does provide camaraderie. It also provides joy. That, again, I get back to that movement of edge and blade, you know, just such a wonderful feeling to get out there and do something that's great. And I think synchro skating is probably a good advent in our sport too, because that is has even more camaraderie than anything.
Absolutely.
I was talking to someone last night who had been a team manager of little girls who were, I think, 10, skating synchro. And she was still talking about how darling they were and how much she loved doing the hair for them, braiding them all in the same way so they all looked identical and so on. I mean, in her case, those kids meant a lot to her too. So it's not just me, it's just everybody. We all are like one big family. PJ, I think of you as family too. I knew your mother so well. I judged with your mother so often. We'd laugh so
many. We laughed a lot.
Yes, we did. Your mother made us laugh a lot, a little bit like you.
Ben Shaw, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. You are a treat, and I hope to run into you in person one of these days.
Well, yes, that's true, PJ. I hope we will too. Thanks
Take
so much
good care.
For listening to the old girl.
Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Let's Talk About It, the Skate Ontario podcast. Don't forget to follow us on social media. I'm at Skating PJ. Until next time, bye for now.